Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very excited to be speaking to Dr. Carl Griffin today about his book titled The Politics of Hunger, Protest, Poverty, and Policy in England from 1750 to 1840, out in 2022 from Manchester University Press. This book offers the first systematic analysis of the idea of hunger and how this was something that was experienced during this time period, feared during this time period, and influenced politics and policy in a whole bunch of really interesting ways. So this book has quite a lot to tell us about social policy, about kind of discourses, and a lot of other things about England in this time. So Carl, I'm very pleased to welcome you to the podcast to tell us about your book.
Hi, Miranda. My book is, as with so many academic books, is something of a long-standing project and a labour of love. I am a historical geographer, so I'm kind of interested in both time and space in the past. And my particular kind of interests from the start of my career have been focused on rural England from roughly the beginning of the 18th century through to the middle of the 19th century. And most of my work, I suppose the stuff I'm best known for, is work on popular protest and popular politics. And it was through that work, in particular, particularly going to work on food riots, that I kind of came to realise that there was a huge kind of gap in the historiography on hunger. So that's to say, there's a huge amount of kind of work that's been written about famine in an English context, with the idea that it's something that really stops being an issue by the early 17th century. And also an interesting kind of body of work that focuses on the later kind of 19th century, where hunger supposedly had reappeared, had been reimagined, had been rediscovered as a social problem. But in this kind of intervening period, there was this kind of huge gap in our knowledge, where, and I think it'd be fair to say, historical scholars had assumed that hunger simply wasn't an issue in any kind of major way, that the focus on famine, which has been such a kind of dominant kind of feature in so much kind of work in the social sciences and more kind of socially kind of inflected humanities, that had rather kind of overshadowed, had, you know, maybe kind of completely kind of blocked out any light for thinking about kind of more kind of nuanced understandings and appreciations for the way in which hunger actually kind of persisted as something which was kind of a very kind of lived issue and a major social problem for the 18th and early 19th century. The politics of hunger is this attempt then to fill this gap in our knowledge of the 18th and early 19th century in relation to this more kind of nuanced understanding of hunger, something which was kind of a lived reality for many people, and also something which was kind of a critical driver of social policy and social commentary in the period.
Thank you for introducing sort of the book's origins and kind of the gap it's looking at. I think that's really quite interesting, and hopefully we'll get to kind of do, you know, a bit of a highlights tour, I suppose, of the book, get a sense of the book. And although the title does sort of imply that it starts from 1750, as you've sort of implied already, this idea of hunger having an impact on society has much older origins, but also kind of some immediate ones. So I was wondering if I could ask you a bit about what's in the book, and of course you've already spoken, as in your work more generally, about the idea of food riots, and particularly the food riots in the 1740s. What was so significant about these, particularly when it comes to understanding hunger?
So there's a really, really long history of what are broadly understood as acts of crowd interventions around issues to do with food supply and food quality, going back into the medieval period. But it's not really until 1740 that we see what can be kind of understood of as a genuinely national wave of riots that encompass large parts of the country and draw in rapidly developing urban centres in the north and the Midlands into food riots for the first time. So there's this really kind of interesting kind of diffusion of riots from one place to another, which is something of a factor in kind of earlier kind of food riots, but the fact that it's this kind of national kind of diffusion, this kind of critical kind of national picture, drawing in kind of new and emerging kind of settlements. So it's really, really interesting, and it's really, really important. It's something that's not been subject to a huge amount of study. There's some kind of really, really important work by the American historian John Bost, and the work of Adrian Randall has been kind of important in starting to develop a deeper sense as to what was going on in 1740. But I mean, I see it as absolutely kind of the pivotal kind of moment at which we can begin to kind of understand how the politics of the politics of hunger, as expressed around kind of issues of food supply, as expressed around kind of issues of around the issues of the marketing and regulation of the marketing of food, become this kind of way in which we can understand kind of broader kind of popular mentalities and kind of broader kind of attitudes as to kind of, you know, how the poorer members of society, those who had to kind of work for a living, had kind of this kind of interesting kind of relationship with food, and how that kind of fed into their broader kind of conception of their role in politics, in popular politics. So it kind of touches upon so many kind of critical kind of dynamics for the period.
And one thing I found really interesting reading the book is kind of, as you've just given us a good overview of, the 1740s riots are really quite impactful, right? Nothing on that kind of scale has really been seen before, and shows that this is clearly a very salient issue, despite the fact that, as you mentioned in your first answer, the idea of hunger still being a problem for England was kind of reported, at least by elites, that like, oh, that's not a problem anymore. And yet, as you demonstrate, it's not like the 1740s are kind of this big last gasp of the issue. In fact, food riots and protests continue throughout the period into the early 1800s, but not quite in the same ways, or at least not entirely in the same ways. So can you maybe take us through how food riots and protests changed from the sort of 1740s as the starting point through the rest of that century?
Yeah, absolutely. So So the wave of kind of riots in the 1740s kind of set up a lot of the protest modes, the protest practices, which become kind of defining features of kind of food riots throughout the 18th century. So interventions around attempts to kind of export food from the community, that export doesn't necessarily mean kind of overseas, invariably kind of it means going into kind of major kind of urban markets, either kind of nearby or at a distance. Interventions in marketplaces around either what could be perceived to be kind of unfair marketing practices, unfair kind of manipulation of foodstuffs, or more kind of broadly around what were thought to be kind of unfair prices. So not kind of high prices per se, but kind of prices which were the result of manipulation. So 1740s kind of sets that instead, and a lot of that is evident in the waves of food riots, which we're going to see in 1756, 1757, 1766, to extend to slightly kind of less kind of intense wave of kind of riots in 1772, like slightly more in the east of England rather than being truly national, up until what is absolutely kind of peak food rioting in 1795. And in 1795, there are some fundamental differences. So those kind of ways of food rioting kind of mid-century broadly kind of follow the model of the 1740s. But 1790s kind of step it up in terms of the overall level of intensity. So more places are drawn into food rioting than ever before. Something I've been looking at in some of the work I've been doing actually subsequent to finishing The Politics of Hunger, shown that more rural communities were drawn into this wave of food rioting in the 1790s than had been the case before as well. But it's important to kind of state that what makes the 1790s different, what makes them distinctive, is that the major wave of food rioting in 1795, and it kind of goes on into early 1796 as well, is it's kind of happening against the background of heavily kind of militarized landscape. So Britain is obviously at war in continental Europe. It's kind of a very large standing, very large mobilized kind of army, not just fighting in Europe, but also at home as well. An army that's there both for training purposes, but also to try and keep internal order. And that's kind of necessary because of the broader kind of politics of the 1790s. So there is the rise of French inspired kind of revolutionary politics, with kind of an intensity that hadn't been seen in the preceding decades in the late 17th and in the late 18th century. And this kind of feeds into a paranoia in government circles and amongst kind of the landed elite that, mass rioting, not just in the towns, but even in the countryside, is something that potentially could turn into or bleed into England's revolutionary moment, that the events that have been seen in Paris could also be seen in London. So the reaction to food rioting in a lot of locales, not all, but lots in 1790, is a much more kind of bitter, a much more repressive, much more kind of political act to try and stop rioting, to stop rioting feeding and bleeding into to an insurrectionary moment. So whereas kind of in the past, some individuals, a small number of individuals might be made an example of for being kind of ringleaders in food riots. Most individuals, even if they're arrested, were never even brought to trial, or if they were brought to trial, were given kind of a nominal kind of sentence, or were kind of acquitted. In the 1790s, that's very different. It's a much more bitter response, particularly where those involved in rioting were actually kind of mobilised soldiers. There's a wave in the spring of 1795 of food riots which are led by or otherwise or have strong involvement from members of the militia. Members of the militia who are stationed away from home are put up in often pretty kind of poor temporary barracks, often with kind of your fairly kind of meagre supplies of food, often of fairly kind of poor quality. So the whole kind of politics around kind of food supply in 1795, after some pretty kind of poor kind of harvests, and this kind of issue of having to, you know, to feed this kind of huge mobilised army on the continent, you know, brings every kind of working person into the politics of the moment. So the response is of court martials, of militiamen serving militiamen, state funded trials of kind of others who are thought to be kind of active kind of ringleaders in kind of major kind of urban insurrectionary like food riots. So that moment is very, very different. So when again there's kind of another major kind of food crisis in 1800, again after kind of really, really kind of hard winter, after kind of problematic kind of harvests, after kind of issues with integration of kind of food networks, Britain being at war in continental Europe meant that many of the routes, particularly coming out of the Baltic, that once might have been kind of relied upon to kind of supplement kind of Britain's own kind of agrarian kind of breadbasket, were no longer either kind of possible or no longer reliable. So at 1800 and the food crisis then is potentially kind of a moment which is even more serious than 1795, but the response by the genuinely kind of hungry populace is slightly different to 1795. So there is still a significant kind of wave of food rioting, but there's also a much, much more significant resort to what I call the tools of covert protest, particularly in the countryside. So the sending of threatening letters to those who are, say, withholding corn, threats made to, say, millers who were, thought to be manipulating the flour supply, threats made to bakers and others, and also the use of incendiarism, the use of kind of arson to attack those individuals who are thought to be leading to the suffering of the poor. So whether that was kind of farmers, millers, bakers, or particularly kind of those who were involved in the relief of the poor through the poor relief system of the time. So 1800 looks really quite different to anything that's gone before. So yes, there were food riots, significant numbers of food riots, certain kind of locales, particularly kind of in the late summer of 1800, were impacted by really, really kind of intensive food rioting, kind of spilling out of London, but nowhere near the same number of kind of places or the same number of kind of riots occurred in 1800. So there was this kind of much more significant kind of resort to the tools of terror, if you like, for people to protest their lot.
That's absolutely fascinating to kind of hear that progression over time and how these different sort of seemingly outside factors nevertheless very much play into it. What do you think it tells us that there is such a persistence of claims about hunger and starvation from the 1740s to the early 1800s?
Yeah, I think it speaks to the fact that even though Britain is this kind of rapidly industrializing country with supposedly sophisticated models of kind of market integration, with this developed kind of transport model, which kind of allowed for the easy movement of goods, not least through the building of turnpike roads and the canal system, a system which was kind of well integrated as well into international markets. That despite all of that, that when things went wrong, when there was significant kind of harvest failure, and particularly when there was kind of harvest failure accompanied by broader kind of political problems or manipulations in kind of food markets, that it was very, very kind of easy for those who were just about kind of getting by, those who were, you know, not much above the breadline, to quickly kind of fall into an acute, a grinding poverty and a genuine hunger. So going from being poor but being able to survive to not knowing where literally the next food would come from. And I think it's those kind of moments of crisis that perhaps haven't been as well kind of understood previously as they might have been. And the fact that during these kind of moments of crisis, it wasn't simply kind of individuals, reflexively protesting their lot, reflexively protesting because things were not as they would like them, things were not as they had been, but also because against received historical and popular kind of understandings that, you know, that there was absolutely genuine hunger. There were not famines in England in the 18th century, but there were famine-like conditions. And it really wouldn't have taken a great deal, particularly in 1766, which was an absolutely kind of dreadful year, an absolutely kind of grinding, biting crisis, for crisis to have been made famine, if there hadn't been kind of significant kind of interventions in terms of, say, kind of charitable support, if there hadn't been the important kind of blanket of support from the poor law as well. And I think it's that's the thing that makes this kind of really interesting and really, really important, is that just because famine isn't there doesn't mean that, you know, famine-like conditions hadn't been present, and doesn't mean that, you know, the spectre of famine had altogether kind of disappeared from England. It absolutely hadn't in the 18th century. It was, you know, it was a very, very real threat. And being hungry and not knowing where your next food is going to come from is something that, made food this critical political problem, made food something that turned individuals who otherwise got about their kind of daily lives in relatively kind of quiet and quiescent ways into protesters.
Mm. I think this was such a key point of the book, that eliminating famine doesn't mean eliminating hunger, but also that we now know that there were no famines in this period. If we actually put ourselves back into those shoes and go, okay, well, there historically have been famines relatively recently, and now things look quite bad, how do we know that there won't be, right? And I think that this fear of famine and fear of hunger is a really important factor to bring into this conversation, because it's not just about kind of, well, the numbers show that there's X amount of this and X amount of that. You also have to believe it. So I'm really kind of glad you've made that point, because it, I think, brings a lot of nuance in and very helpful to eliminate what's actually happening here. And I kind of want to think about sort of this idea of the perception, as you say, how political this became and how the protests shift and the public policy response shifts. And I kind of want to get into a bit more of that public policy side of it, because you've mentioned sort of the poor law. There's a lot of changes around that in this time. So can you tell us about kind of one of the important shifts in this period around policy related to hunger, which is scales? I admit I wasn't particularly expecting that. I found this fascinating. So how and why do scales represent an important shift in thinking about the poor law?
Yeah, so in the early 1790s, there's this kind of a slowly kind of developing kind of crisis around kind of food and food supply. And it absolutely, yeah, becomes this kind of critical kind of, yeah, unyielding kind of issue in 1795. But as early as 1792, there's kind of evidence to suggest that local authorities, that local groups are kind of magistrates and landowners, genuinely are worried about both the already significantly kind of rising cost of poor relief, so the impact of, yeah, of war as ever as we're experiencing now, is inflation. Inflation particularly kind of, yeah, and most severely kind of impacted in terms of kind of, yeah, food prices, again, as we're seeing now. And what could be done to genuinely have a crisis, so there's kind of properly kind of humanitarian kind of, yeah, without wanting to use an anachronism, probably kind of humanitarian kind of, yeah, motives at play here. But also kind of what mechanisms can be kind of, yeah, developed to kind of systematically support the needy, the genuine, as the magistrates would see it, and make sure that public funds, let's say local public funds, the poor relief monies could be kind of targeted at those who were kind of in greatest need, and those who were thought to be kind of, yeah, most worthy of, yeah, of public support. So there are these kind of interesting kind of early kind of precedents in the opening years of the 1790s, and in 1795, as is often been told by kind of social historians, a group of kind of magistrates get together in the small Berkshire hamlet of Speenhamland. It's not even a parish, it's a, yeah, little kind of hamlet in the broader parish of Speen, and devise this systematic scale for the relief of the poor, tagging the amount of kind of relief kind of necessary for the support of a family to the price of bread being, you know, the central kind of arbiter of, you know, of how kind of a family will feel the effects of inflation. Most of, you know, a kind of a poor labouring family's income would be spent on bread, far more than on rent or anything else. So bread is kind of a useful kind of mechanism to organise this by. So on top of, you know, on top of a family's wages, how much kind of income support, for these scales are genuinely kind of an income support policy, how much support are they going to kind of need to get by when bread is at so many kind of shillings and pence a gallon loaf? So the intentions are kind of interesting, and they're complex. And from this kind of seminal kind of meeting, which has been kind of held up by kind of so many historians as the critical, the pivotal moment. Lots of these other scales kind of appear in other kind of communities, particularly starting in the southern English corn lands, so in places like kind of Hampshire, Dorset, Berkshire, into Sussex, into Kent, and then kind of spreading into kind of other kind of counties too, not least in the in East Anglia and even into the Midlands and the North. And these scales are something that outlive the moment of crisis for which they're kind of initially kind of designed, for which they're initially kind of invented, and instead almost become kind of embedded within local relief policies, within local relief networks. It's important to state that whilst the poor laws at this kind of moment in time operate within kind of a national kind of legal kind of framework, policy is something which is often actually kind of devised at the local level. There's, you know, a great degree of kind of innovation which occurs either at the district level or even the level of the parish being the smallest kind of unit at which kind of monies for poor relief are kind of gathered and at which relief is given out. So these scales become embedded. They become embedded because they serve kind of broader kind of purposes. So beyond kind of the moment of crisis, it quite quickly becomes kind of clear that, Britain's still at war anyway. There's still kind of this problem of chronic inflation. Real wages, particularly for rural workers, throughout the war years, decline. So despite the fact wages are increasing, the cost of goods, the cost of living is increasing. It's increasing at an even faster rate. Again, striking parallels to the early 21st century here. And keeping kind of scales on is kind of a way of kind of responding to that crisis, if you like, in the cost of living. Going to use a slight kind of anachronism from today. But it's also something which can be easily kind of manipulated as well. So in rural communities in particular, farmers are the major employers. Most people who need to kind of labour for a living are working on the land. They're working for farmers. They're engaged as kind of wage labourers. Farmers are kind of therefore kind of able to use the poor relief system, the scale system that's been developed, as a way of actually kind of spreading their costs onto the broader community of ratepayers. So rather than, say, increasing wages, farmers are able to actually kind of keep wages down. They're able to kind of to repress them, and ultimately even to reduce them after the war as well, because if you have these scales in place which guarantee effectively kind of minimum kind of incomes for poor working families, then what's to stop farmers from just kind of cutting wages, because the other kind of ratepayers in the community will also have to kind of chip in to help support them through the poor laws. So it becomes something which becomes this kind of major kind of battleground in kind of social policy circles. It's something which transcends its initial intentions. It's certainly something which kind of leaves behind any kind of humanitarian kind of impulse of the early scales, and instead becomes this kind of system by which everyone who works for a living, particularly in the countryside, is effectively pauperized, because wages are so terribly kind of suppressed, repressed, depressed rather, sorry, that everyone has to kind of turn to the parish, has to turn to the poor law to get support. this is something which is kind of bitterly kind of, yeah, resented by other kind of, yeah, ratepayers in the community, by other kind of individuals who aren't involved directly in farming, but are now having to kind of shoulder a broader cost. It's quite understandably resented by many kind of labouring families as well, because their labour is something no longer adequate to the support of their families, and instead they have to kind of turn to the parish for support, for kind of income support through these scale systems. And these scale systems are never, you know, absolutely kind of, you know, universally applied. There are always kind of, you know, wider kind of stipulations. So there's lots of kind of evidence in parish vestry books that, yeah, sorts of kind of, you know, divisive kind of measures are kind of, yeah, implemented and invented. So, for instance, refusing kind of, yeah, relief to families if they have a dog. Either being kind of evidence that, you know, where you've got, you're able to support a dog, you should be able to feed yourselves, or evidence that you go out poaching, therefore, you know, you're engaged in illegality, you're engaged in criminal acts, refusing to relieve people unless they come to church. So it becomes this kind of tool of social control as well.
Thank you for explaining that. I think the idea of thinking about the parish level is really key, and I'm glad you highlighted that, because otherwise it can be quite confusing, kind of, well, what's national, what's local, and how do different things change? But that lens is quite crucial, and one that you use the sources really effectively, I thought, in the book to kind of draw out, not just about the kind of policies you've talked about so far, but also about literally the cover of the book has a cartoon of the workhouse, which is quite possibly the most common thing people think about because of Charles Dickens. And I was really interested in the book that you bring the idea of the workhouse and the policy of the workhouse into discussions around biopolitical issues and biopolitical work. So I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about kind of the workhouse in the context you've described and how it comes in with biopolitics and the kind of aims of the workhouse in that context.
Yeah, so when the war in Europe ends, 1814 to 1815, and the mobilized kind of army returns home, those kind of individuals need to go back to their communities. A lot of them are returning to the fields and the farms in which they were brought up. They're looking for work. At the same time, because there's no longer this kind of huge demand to kind of feed this mobilized army, and also because, you know, international kind of markets reopen, the cost of goods, particularly the cost of, yeah, goods at the farm gate, very, very sharply declines. So farmers, having had it really very, very good indeed during the war years, now have to kind of find ways of, yeah, of reducing their costs. This is happening at the same time, as to say, as, you know, the size of the labour market is significantly swollen by these returning soldiers. And this leads to kind of, you know, a really, really kind of massive crisis, and one of the deepest, not just recessions, but genuine depressions in the English economy. So from 1815, unemployment soars in the countryside particularly, but also in industrial centres too. Some rural communities quite quickly are suffering from meaningful kind of unemployment rates around 20%. Also, significant kind of rises in underemployment as well. And because of the scale kind of system that had been kind of embedded, particularly in rural communities in the 1790s, these same communities through the poor law are now having to support individuals for whom there is no work or not enough work. So the cost of poor law now absolutely spikes again. So this kind of significant kind of spike in the 1790s, which kind of falls off a little, kind of plateaus through the rest of the war years, now massively increases again to kind of levels which had never been seen before. And this, further kind of politicizes the poor law, the poor law system. Money, kind of poor relief, is given ever more kind of grindingly. There are ever more kind of inventions and social policy kind of innovations around how around costs can be reduced. So particularly through kind of the hiring of salaried poor law workers, assistant overseers. So before that, I mean, all of the labour in terms of administering the poor law tended to be done, for nothing on a rotation basis amongst the rate payers. So these innovations around bringing paid overseers who can look into claimants' backgrounds, look into their kind of family situation, look into their income, look into their kind of their habits and their morals even. There are these kind of innovations around introductions of things called select vestries, these small cabals who are thought to be better kind of able to cut down on any kind of abuses at the level of the parish, because they'd be much small cabal of often kind of the larger ratepayers would be kind of less kind of swayed by the pleas and the demands of claimants who might be kind of related or kind of closer in status to some of the lesser ratepayers. So all of these kind of innovations are brought in and ultimately have some kind of effect, but because of kind of poor relief and this crisis around kind of un and underemployment is something that that kind of rumbles on through the later kind of 1810s and into the 1820s. Everything flares up in 1830 with the largest series of rural protests that England had seen, at least since the Peasants' Revolt of 1381. Series of kind of protests, essentially kind of around the standard of living of the rural poor, stingy kind of poor relief payments, around poverty and pauperizing levels of wages, around their poor treatment by employers and by poor law officials, around declining employment opportunities because of the introduction of machinery, particularly kind of threshing machines, which robbed workers of precious and rare wintertime employment when the fields were frozen over. And this is another kind of insurrectionary moment, another kind of moment which is kind of feared to be potentially kind of revolutionary. There'd been a revolution in France in the summer of 1830, kind of revolutions elsewhere in continental Europe, and again there was this kind of fear that the revolt of the countryside would be something which would spill over into kind of the urban reform crisis of the time and would lead to a revolutionary kind of situation in England. It didn't, but the response of the state again was a bitter repression, both of many of those who'd been most kind of obviously kind of towing a particular kind of political line during the protest, during the swing riots of 1830. And the other kind of response is by launching the first kind of major social policy inquiry in the history of England, and this kind of significant kind of moments in kind of social policy innovation into the poor laws and what could be done. So there's this belief amongst the Whig elite that the abuse of the poor laws lay at the heart of all of the problems. That by making laborers kind of pauperized, they've also made them indolent and needy. That they've kind of reduced their kind of incentive and will to work and support themselves. And what's needed is this kind of full-scale kind of reform, which makes living on the parish, which makes living off kind of poor relief something which is not desirable. Now, of course, it wasn't desirable in any way at all. But there was this kind of, this kind of major kind of political kind of belief, particularly amongst the utilitarians, the Whigs, drawing upon the arguments of Jeremy Bentham and Thomas Malthus, that major reform of the poor laws was necessary. And what's kind of proposed out of this major kind of inquiry, which is kind of rigged to produce the result which is wanted, is that the relief of the poor on the parish is something which should be kind of abolished. Instead, parishes should be put together in unions, at the centre of which is the workhouse, and that all individuals, if they want to receive a relief, should go and be relieved in the workhouse, that their kind of independence is taken away from them. Now, this is a system, this new poor law that comes in 1834, and it kind of builds upon kind of examples and experiments with kind of workhouses in other locations, which had been ongoing really from the early 17th century. But the workhouse here was a system which was being imposed upon all communities, and there was supposed to be no exceptions, so the young, the old, those who weren't able to support themselves and their families through work all had to go into the workhouse without exception. There were kind of moments when kind of the system kind of broke down and was so totally overwhelmed that some relief outside the workhouse was available. But this is kind of essentially kind of a biopolitical kind of system. It doesn't see the individual, it doesn't see their situation, it doesn't look at their context. It's not concerned with them and their life. Rather, it's concerned with the level of the population. It's concerned with thinking about the poor en masse and thinking about how they, rather than any poor individuals, can be supported at the cheapest possible rate. The system is this kind of the construction of these incredibly austere centralized workhouses which divide individuals up by sex and by age, so separate children's wards are taken away from the parents. Men and women are separated too. There are kind of separate kind of wards for the elderly, and everyone who is able to work in the workhouse is put to work. Everyone is dressed in the same kind of uniform. Their individuality is stripped from them. Their kind of sense of self-worth is stripped from them too. It is meant to be a deterrent system. It is meant to offer kind of a level of minimum support. So there are all sorts of interesting kind of experiments kind of early on, thinking about what is the minimum amount of food and which is necessary to support a human body. So this is kind of going on around the same time as the invention of the discovery of the calorie, and all sorts of kind of innovations in kind of human biology as kind of a science. So these kind of workhouses are reducing individuals who, through no fault of their own, find themselves in this kind of destitute kind of position, down to the level of very, very kind of simply, very, very crudely of bare life, to draw on the work of Giorgio Agamben. And not too surprisingly, this is kind of a system which is universally kind of hated. It's universally hated in the countryside, because, you know, agricultural kind of wages remain very, very, very kind of low. It's very, very difficult for families to kind of, yeah, support themselves without some support, or without turning to crime to support themselves and their families. It's hated in the towns, where there are much kind of broader kind of communities of kind of ratepayers, many of whom are, you know, not that kind of far kind of removed from, you know, from the bottom rung of society themselves. You know, individuals who might be doing okay, but, you know, have just kind of lifted themselves up from kind of, you know, from kind of destitution, and are only kind of one step away from destitution, and who see kind of, yeah, the workhouse system as this kind of dreadful kind of imposition upon their community, who see it as this kind of act of state centralization, of taking kind of power away from kind of local communities in determining how they should kind of care for their own. And it is this kind of, this kind of first act of state centralization around kind of, around social policy. It's very, very quickly followed by the invention of kind of, county kind of police forces, which are again a response to the swing insurrection of 1830. But the workhouse is something which is incredibly powerful, and bitterly, bitterly kind of resisted. But, you know, it's important because, you know, it uses hunger. It turns kind of hunger into a tool of government.
Mm. Very important. And I really appreciated both, obviously, that explanation, but also that you kind of, given that you've spoken about kind of looking at people at the level of population rather than individual, looking at the cheapest way, stripping individuality and things like that, as I was reading that section, I started to make some sort of some connections to other parts of British history at this particular time, especially around race and empire, and then turned the page and found that you have done that as well and done it properly in the book. So I was wondering if you could kind of expand this conversation, this answer you've just given us, into the wider context and conversation of race and empire in this time period in England.
Yeah, so I argue in the politics of hunger that the early 19th century in particular, although, you know, this kind of, some of these kind of ideas are kind of emergent kind of in the end of the 18th century too, it's kind of a period in which the rural poor in particular, or this applies in some contexts to some kind of urban and industrial workers too, are increasingly seen not as heroic, not as kind of, you know, serving the interests of the nation by their kind of, you know, irreversible backbreaking work in the fields, you know, providing for the populace, but instead seen as a problem. There are too many of them. They are ill educated. They are needy. They always kind of, you know, need kind of your support from the poor laws. That as kind of your Reverend kind of Malthus kind of, you know, famously saw it as well, that the systems in which they kind of, you know, live encourage them to early marriage and to have kind of children at an earlier age. I mean, the actual kind of realities behind that are far more complex than Malthus's initial kind of argument in his essay on population. And it's through all of these kind of, you know, these kind of emergent kind of discourses about the rural poor in particular, that they're increasingly seen as kind of, you know, a different type of people they're increasingly spoke of, written of, in broadly kind of racial terms. And this is something which kind of feeds into the languages and the techniques of governance and the tools of of science, the emergent social sciences around kind of colonial kind of rule elsewhere. And a lot of this kind of language, a lot of these techniques are brought back to use to kind of describe the poor of England. So lots of comparisons are kind of made between how they are and how displaced kind of Aboriginal peoples are, say in Australia. Lots of comparisons are made between the situation, the state of the English rural labourer, and those enslaved or once enslaved kind of peoples in the English Caribbean as well, and the British Caribbean. So there's this kind of a conflation of lots of emergent kind of ideas from metropole and from the colony, which are then kind of applied back onto thinking about the labour. So this kind of this individual, this group who have been seen as a problem are now seen as not just kind of a problem, but altogether apart. They are kind of writ in racial terms. They are kind of considered to be, to be a different type of people. They are considered to be, in many kind of instances, an altogether kind of different race from their social betters. Mm.
Very interesting link to make there. So thank you for explaining it. There obviously have been some hints already that there very well might be things about this history that are relevant today, with the anachronisms of the cost of living crisis, the impact of war on inflation and food prices. But maybe you could tell us sort of more directly, how does this history of kind of hunger, particularly in England in a specific time period, matter today?
That's a really, really interesting set of questions. I mean, when I started writing the book, it was never my kind of intention to kind of to write it to something which directly kind of spoke to kind of the crises of the 21st century. But from the first moment I metaphorically picked up my pen, it just became absolutely kind of clear that whilst the broader kind of situations and contexts of the 18th, early 19th century quite different from the early 21st century, of course they are, that there are so many striking parallels around the assumption then and now that that hunger was something that simply was no longer an issue, that for instance, in the early 21st century, that the welfare state and low level kind of charity was making sure that everyone had everything that they might reasonably kind of need to get by and kind of participate as active citizens. And that's remarkably kind of similar to the set of kind of beliefs around hunger no longer being a problem that were true in the 18th and early 19th century. So I think there are these kind of striking kind of overlaps in terms of discourse, and it reminds us, of course, that hunger is something that is only ever kind of a few steps away from large sections of the population. And when that's something as well that is kind of exacerbated by a cost of living crisis, by kind of rampant inflation in a period of wartime, in a period of political kind of instability. The years that I've spoken to kind of earlier on, so 1795, 1830, and we're also kind of moments of kind of political uncertainty, moments of political kind of crisis. And yeah, that's it's absolutely kind of been true, say, of, you know, of 2021 and 2022 in the UK, and arguably in kind of, you know, other parts of the world too. Certainly true of, you know, the States in 2021. Certainly true of, you know, large parts of kind of continental Europe. Let alone thinking about the unfurling kind of, you know, internal kind of crises and their kind of repressions in China. So there are parallels there too. And that matters because, you know, thinking about these histories then speaks directly to where we are today and serve as kind of a salutary warning to those who try to govern over us, those who we either kind of vote into kind of office who kind of assume kind of positions of power without any kind of democratic authority or mandate, that they need to be very, very careful in thinking about how they respond in these moments of crisis to issues of hunger, to the very, very real biting and grinding reality of hunger, to make sure that they don't forget about what happened in the late 18th and early 19th century, thinking about the good intentions initially of kind of scale systems, about how they became manipulated to kind of, yeah, to create a greater problem of pauperization and how they kind of, yeah, demoralized a whole kind of, yeah, class of workers, how the crises were also kind of used to kind of justify the dreaded workhouse system, which proved to be kind of so kind of catastrophic. And, you know, lives on in, you know, the collective and kind of cultural memory of the nation, as, you know, as this kind of symbol of kind of an unfeeling, of a grinding governance that is interested only in the bottom line, interested only in the level of population rather than interested in the individual.
Now that you've taken us through the history, the present and how it relates, as my last question, I was wondering if we could peek into the future a little bit. Is there anything that you're working on now that this project is done or you've got your eye on to work on next that you want to give the audience a sort of brief sneak peek into?
So I'm really lucky this year that I've been awarded a fellowship from the Levy Hume Trust to further some of my ongoing work on the history of squatting on particularly in rural England and the edge of towns, and thinking about how in this same time period, the 18th and early 19th century, that it was kind of possible for the landless poor, who otherwise had to kind of rely on, yeah, their labour, had to kind of rely on poor relief, how they were kind of able in some locations, in some kind of situations, to kind of, yeah, eke out an existence by, you know, by taking a small bit of land from common land, from manorial wastes, to erect a cottage and maybe create a small garden and find some kind of little bit of comfort and little bit of kind of independence from these kind of otherwise kind of rather kind of oppressive systems of agrarian capitalism. So that's kind of the major thing that I'm working on. I've still got ongoing kind of interest in thinking about food rights. So just had a paper out in the Historical Journal looking at rural food rights, which hadn't been systematically kind of studied before. I'm working more kind of generally as well on kind of your histories of the enclosure of once common land. So thinking about kind of issues of the privatization, the making private of land, and particularly how that kind of played out in England in a colonial context. So how kind of again the languages of kind of empire, the languages particularly for the settler colonialism, were kind of used to kind of justify the final kind of moments of enclosure of commons and wastelands in England.
Fascinating. Well, best of luck with those projects. And while you're off working on them, listeners can read the book we've been discussing titled The Politics of Hunger, Protest, Poverty and Policy in England from 1750 to 1840, out from Manchester University Press. Carl, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
It's been my absolute pleasure, Miranda. Thank you.